Wine Stories, a podcast to discover the world of wine by Étienne Pommier.
July 1999, 10:30 a.m., Tbilisi, Georgia. A black Mercedes with tinted windows pulls out on Tel Aviv Street and two men step out of the car walking towards the hotel lobby. The man in front has a dark, short hair matching the hard, almost brutal features on his face. His name is Nino Meskishvili. He casually reaches to his belt and pulls out a handgun that he gives to the bored-looking security guard as he walks through the metal detector. But as the man behind him opens his brown leather jacket to take out his own pistol, the security officer straightens up and keeps a close eye on him as he passes through the gates. Nino walks across the lobby towards two foreigners waiting on a burgundy sofa and asks with a thick accent, "You sleep good? You ready? This is Piotr. He's helpful." The man named Piotr looks at them with a level gaze and quietly but firmly shakes their hands. He's in his 30s, with an unshaven beard, and despite his shorter size, there is something dangerously quiet about him. And he looks like he could easily win a fight against any of them. Ex-military, maybe.
"We can go. George is waiting."
Still on alert, the security guards hand their guns back to the Georgians as they walk out and get in the car, followed by the two Westerners looking mildly confused and worried. "You know, John, if we were to run to the airport and catch the first flight out of this place, now would be the time."
"Come on, Kevin. If they were going to shoot us, they could have done it last night on the way from the airport. Where's your sense of adventure?"
In fact, the adventure had already started the night before when John and Kevin landed at 1:30 a.m. after a 30-hour trip from Australia to be greeted by Nino and their local contact, George, at the airport. Guided to a small room with a sign saying VIP welcome area, they were introduced to two other men, one of them a representative for the Georgian Ministry of Industry and Commerce. In the middle of the room, a plate with chocolate and sparkling red wine was prepared for the welcome reception. After polite smiling and toasting until 2 a.m., despite being completely jet-lagged, the two guests were escorted to their hotel for their first night in Georgia. What are they doing here? They've traveled halfway across the world on a quest to find an authentic treasure, the Lost Ark of Wine, a unique collection thought to be long lost. How did they come to hear about it, and what brought them to Georgia? Well, in order to understand, we have to go back to the fall of 1998 in Sydney, when they came across a very peculiar wine list. Sydney, Australia, September 1988. John Baker and Kevin Hopko run the wine store Double Bay Cellars in the eastern suburbs of the country's largest city when they are called upon by one of their occasional associates, Harry Zukor, to inspect a private cellar up for sale. As they do the inventory, catalogue and inspect the bottles, they cannot take their mind off another peculiar list that Harry sent to them a few days earlier. A list printed on a piece of paper headlined Mineral Exploration and with names such as Gilshire, Oprian, Palmer and dates like 1725, 1831, 1888. If the dates are vintages, the list describes a potentially highly valuable cellar, but they don't really understand what the weird names refer to. A few days later, Kevin walks in John's office announcing that he has cracked the code. The weird names are just wrongly spelled and refer to famous Bordeaux chateaus. Oprian is Chateau Aubrion. Aikin is Chateau d'Yquem. Latour is Chateau Latour. The dates are indeed vintages. And in another column, remarks such as 0.75 or 0.4 likely correspond to bottle sizes. But the last column describing the quantity is the one that really catches their attention. 12,
6, 11, 18, 21. Thousands of bottles altogether. If this is real, the partners are looking at one of the world's most exceptional collection of very old wines, most of them over a century old and in ridiculous quantities. If this is real. In order to find out, they reach out to Harry, who tells them that he got the list from a friend of his who runs a mining company with interests in a Georgian gold mine, Neville Rhodes. An appointment is made, and all four men gather in the mining company's headquarters in Sydney to discuss the list. Neville explains that he's formed a partnership with a local businessman named George Aramashvili, who told him that besides the mining deal, he was also involved in a winery with a cellar full of antique wines, and he was looking for a buyer.
"So I'll get to the point, gentlemen," said Neville. "To have access to a cellar with 50,000 bottles of wine, with this kind of remarkable provenance, strikes me as a really great opportunity to..."
I'm sorry to cut you off, Neville," says John, "but what provenance?" Looking surprised, Neville turns his head towards Harry.
"You haven't told them the provenance of the wine?"
"I didn't want to spoil the surprise," says Harry.
"You don't know where it comes from. It's history."
"Believe me," Kevin says, "we are more than ready for someone to finally tell us."
"Well, here is where I would expect the deal becomes amazing from the point of view of wine merchants such as yourselves, gentlemen. Because if it wasn't good enough to have tens of thousands of bottles of incredible wines from pre-1900 to sell, what does it add to the sell price if it turns out that they once belonged to a man named Nicholas Alexandrovich?
Nicholas II, the last Tsar of Russia?"
"Exactly. And then after him, to Joseph Stalin. After the Bolshevik Revolution, all the Tsar's possessions became property of the state, and after Lenin's death, the state was ruled by none other than Stalin. But during World War II, when Stalin became worried about the Nazis invading Russia, he sent many of the treasures away to all corners of the country. Apparently, he split the collection into three. A large part was sent to the Massandra winery in Crimea. Another lot has disappeared. And the third part was sent to Stalin's homeland in Georgia, and it's still sitting there today." Then Neville proceeds to show them poor quality pictures of an old cellar with bottle racks covered in cobwebs and dusty bottles, explaining that the cellar is real. After lengthy discussions, the four men decide to form a partnership to buy the cellar, with John and Kevin going to Tbilisi to meet George and inspect the bottles. And a few months later, John and Kevin land in Georgia, hoping to get a look at Stalin's elusive wine cellar. The handguns in the belts, the security guards on alert looking at Piotr in the hotel lobby, the black Mercedes with tainted windows, and Nino's ruthless driving ignoring traffic lights give John and Kevin an uncomfortable feeling as they speed across the narrow roads of the Georgian capital. This feels much more like some sort of mafia business rather than a due diligence on a wine cellar. After half an hour, they arrive at the Savan No. 1 winery to be greeted by George as well as several other winery directors and executives. The place is vast, with many people wandering around, but there seems to be no wine business going on. The vats, the pumps, the hoses are all dry and dusty and clearly haven't been used in a very long time. And there are no pallets of wines ready to be shipped. When they ask George if this place is making wine, he only responds,
"No wine, but soon."
The first day is spent in meeting rooms, listening to the winery executives explain the origins of the winery and what it would become with fresh capital. And the more the day goes on, the more the two wine merchants have the weird feeling that the Georgians are talking to them like potential buyers for this derelict winery. There is no mention of the wine cellar, not a word about the old bottles, and the two Australians start doubting that the wine actually exists. The first day ends with a dinner in a traditional restaurant in the heart of Tbilisi,
and the two merchants go to bed with the unsettling impression that they might have traveled all this way for a scam. Even George's position is unclear. Neville talked about him as the manager of the winery, but the meetings have clearly shown that he's not the only one to make the decisions, if he actually can. On the next day, the two Australians are back at the winery and make it clear to George that if they don't see the bottles today, there is no point for them staying in Georgia, and they might as well go back to Sydney. The winery executives show them a list of wines and start arguing that the bottles are downstairs but that they won't let them see it because they don't want them to touch the stock. After a heated discussion in Georgian between George and the executives, they eventually agree to open the cellar doors, and the cellar manager, Grigold, shows up with a bunch of keys leading the way down the narrow staircase. At the bottom of the stairs, Grigold steps into a small alcove and flicks on several rows of dim overhead lights. The room is cold and damp, filled with racks 20 bottles high, extending as far as the eye can see into the darkness. Thousands of bottles covered in dust and cobwebs. The cellar manager reaches out to one of the racks, pulls out a wine bottle, and says, in a surprisingly passable attempt at French pronunciation, 1899 Chateau Soudouiro. John and Kevin are trying their best to keep a poker face on, but here it is, Stalin's elusive cellar, the Tsar's wine collection taken by the Bolsheviks and hidden from the Nazis during World War II. The cellar, the dust, the cobwebs, thousands of bottles on the racks cannot be a con. This is the real deal, the lost ark of wine. As John is almost overwhelmed considering the cellar around him, Mr. Revaz, the winery executive, mishandles the bottles of century-old Sauternes rendered slippery by the ambient humidity and drops it. The bottle plunges to the floor and breaks. Everybody is speechless, and the executive is bright red with embarrassment when Kevin smiles and says, "That was a brilliant idea, Mr. Revaz. We would not have dreamed of being so rude as to ask you to open a bottle, but now we can taste the wine." Piotr translates, Revaz smiles with relief, George laughs, and the staff brings a few glasses and a cloth to filter the glass shards out of the wine left in the bottle. A lovely richness, shades of apricot, gorgeous Sauternes sweetness, but almost ethereal on the palate. This is the real deal. John and Kevin spend the next few days in the cellar inventorying and inspecting bottles, coming up with a list of wines and vintages that would blow the mind of any wine merchant or auctioneer. Here is the list for Chateau d'Yquem alone. 1940, 3 bottles. 1924, 42. 1891, 11. 1888, 2. 1881, 10 bottles. 1877, 3 bottles. 1874, 17, 1864, 19, 1861, 5 bottles, 1859, 5 bottles, 1858, 21, 1854, 6, 1851, 6, 1847, 3 bottles, and 64 bottles without a vintage mentioned. All in all, 217 bottles of Chateau d'Yquem, most of them from the 19th century. But the cellar doesn't contain only the Tsar's collection. There are also thousands of bottles of old Georgian wines, and in order to convince the Australians of the greatness of their homeland production, the winery executives pull out a few bottles for tasting. There is a white Sinandali 1978 with a sheep's wool sort of nose, not unlike an old Chenin Blanc, a Kigvi 1932, a fortified wine with sweet raisins notes reminiscent of an old port, and another Tsinandali white from 1920, completely dry with notes of butterscotch. These aren't the crown jewels of the collection, but they are genuine, and the two merchants know that they will have to take them too in order to buy the whole lot. In a corner of the wine cellar, there is another shelf aside from the rest of the collection. When they ask about it, George hands them a list written in Georgian that reads, "The collection of Joseph Vissarionovich Stalin." Stalin's private stash. A lot of gin, spirits, and fortified sweet wines. By the end of the week, John and Kevin have catalogued thousands of bottles of wine and have a clear idea of the exact contents of the cellar. However, the look of the bottles and the tasting of the 1899 Sudbury aren't enough to finalize the purchase of a $1 million collection. The two merchants need the bottles to be examined by experts, at the shadow if possible, in order to make sure that they are authentic and that they can actually be sold, since many of them don't have a label anymore. So they negotiate with George and the winery executives to take a dozen bottles with them back to Australia. A few thousand dollars later, the bottles are carefully packed in a box and the two merchants can spend their last night in Tbilisi enjoying the city's nightlife. On the next day, at the airport, George bids them farewell and adds, "Don't you worry, the bottles are real. All will be well, we'll all be rich." As they sit down in the plane, John turns to Kevin and tells him, "It's good, we're safely on the plane." "Yes, safe, sound, and ready to fly," says Kevin, "until they arrest us at Heathrow." In their discussions about the collection and how to make the deal happen, John and Kevin have come up with several questions that need answers in order to go ahead with the purchase. First, the bottles must be authenticated, at least the dozen they're bringing back with them. Secondly, they need to sort out with George the true ownership of the bottles to make sure that he is actually entitled to sell them. Thirdly, they will need to figure out a way to get the wine out of Georgia safely, because the scenario where they wire the money and the bottles disappear forever still seems like a probable outcome. And finally, they need to have the green light from the Georgian authorities, and this might prove to be the biggest concern. John said it to George at the airport. "We can't give you your money, even get the wines out of the cellar to London or New York, and then have a representative of the Georgian government turning up announcing that they own the wines either through shares in the wineries or because the bottles are cultural icons, not just wines for sale." Think about it for a second. The private collection of the last Tsar of Russia that belonged to Joseph Stalin, Georgia's most famous or infamous personality, hidden in a cellar in the heart of Tbilisi? Will Georgian authorities really let it go? What if they claim that they are historical artifacts, a national treasure of cultural significance? Then the whole deal would be off. Back in Sydney, John and Kevin share their thoughts with Harry and Neville and agree to discuss all these issues with George while, simultaneously, asking lawyers to look at the potential legal hurdles of the deal. Over the next few months, George's responses become more and more vague, asking for the money to be wired, but without providing a clear answer on the true ownership of the bottles or the authorizations required from the Georgian government. Since Neville is involved in the mining business in Georgia, John tries to ask him to follow it up with his local partner, but Neville has suddenly become very difficult to reach. And when John finally manages to talk to him, he eludes the questions and cuts the call short. A few weeks later, John learns that the bank account the four partners had opened for this joint venture has been closed by Harry, and a few days later, he and Kevin receive a letter from Neville's lawyer informing them that he has acquired the Georgian cellar and asks for the immediate return of the dozen bottles brought back to Sydney, threatening to involve his lawyers. Every good story needs a treason, it seems. Convinced that they haven't done anything wrong, John and Kevin decide to end the joint venture by splitting in four shares equal in value the dozen bottles they've brought back from Georgia. So each partner will get his share of the wine that was obtained, and there will be no room for dispute. Here is how they decide to split the bottles in early 2000. Harry
will receive a bottle of Chateau Coutet 1864 in pristine condition and of very high value that he was very keen on. Neville gets a Margaux 1919, an Ikem 1858, and a bottle of Georgian wine Salchino 1956. Kevin takes a bottle of Ikem 1870-something. The last digit is unreadable. Maybe 1870, which is an amazing vintage, but maybe not. And John receives a Mouton 1874 and 6 bottles of old wines from the Georgian collection, including a Redstone White Muscat 1945 from the Massandra Winery in Crimea. 3 years later, having gone their separate ways since splitting the dozen, John and Kevin reconnect in Sydney, and Kevin mentions that he has heard from George again after emailing him about rugby during the 2003 World Cup in Australia. Apparently, George is still in charge at Savan No. 1 Winery. Neville is out of the picture, having failed his local partners, and the collection is still up for sale. Since they still have their share of the dozen, John and Kevin decide to have it authenticated themselves. Kevin entrusts his bottle of Ikem 1870-something to John, who will take it to the chateau in Sauterne thanks to a local Bordeaux contact who will arrange a meeting with Pierre Liotot. In the summer of 2003, John travels to France with the bottle and plans to go to Chateau d'Yquem after spending a few days in Paris with his wife. Unfortunately, as he is loading his luggage into a taxi, the wine bag falls on the ground and old Sauterne starts seeping out of the broken Ikem bottle on the Parisian pavement. Fortunately for John, so to speak, the bottle was tightly packed in bubble wrapping, so not much of the wine has escaped, and he manages to save most of it and transfer it into small water bottles. The bottle is broken, yes, but at least he will still have some wine to present at Chateau d'Yquem. A few days later, in Sauterne, he tells the whole story to Pierre Lurton and cellar master Sandrine Gabay. The weird list, the connection with the Tsar and Stalin, the cellar in Tbilisi, the tasting of the 1899 Sudriro, the dozen brought back from Georgia, the incident in Paris, and he proceeds to show them the broken bottle and the leftover wine. They inspect the bottle and the cork and find them consistent with the era, and then proceed to taste the wine. Even slightly oxidized, the wine is rich, almost caramel flavored, but with a characteristic underlying acidity. John is barely breathing as Sandrine Gabay takes one more sip and finally says, "I do believe this is genuine Ikem from the 1870s. After the tasting at Chateau d'Yquem, John is relieved. The cellar master has authenticated the wine, and Pierre Lurton has offered him to authenticate all the other bottles if he could have them brought to Paris. He is now confident that the cellar is authentic and can be sold in an auction, provided that he and Kevin can sort out the logistics and the payment. But the actual ownership of the bottles is still unclear, and the potential cultural significance of the lot hasn't been sorted out either, and John's lawyer argues that this is still a major risk. In his last email, George was getting pushy about making the payment, but it's been a few days and John hasn't been able to reach him over the phone or to get an answer to his emails ever since. One evening, John Baker is hosting a fine wine tasting in his new wine store when Kevin Hopko joins him. As the two partners discuss one more time their options to close the deal, a man steps into the shop. Closely cropped dark hair, a stubbled beard, wearing a leather jacket above a polo with a gold chain around his neck, he looks slightly dangerous yet calm.
"Hello, Mr. John. Surprise."
"Hello, Piotr. You're a long way from home.
I'd like to visit your country and see also your business."
"I've been trying to raise Georgi on the phone for some time, Piotr. How are things with him?"
"It might be best if you no longer try to contact George."
"What do you mean? Is he no longer in charge at the winery or this business deal?"
"There is no deal. Many things have changed, John. As far as you're concerned, He is no longer somebody to talk to.
Then who should we talk to? Who's now in charge?
That is what I said, John. You hear, but you're not listening. There is nobody for you to talk to anymore. There is no talk. People I worked for, they would like you to know that it is time for you to walk away from Tbilisi.
And may I ask who you work for, Piotr?
It may be better you don't know. Some people now in Russia, in Georgia, are dangerous people to know their name. I protect you here. Just need you to understand what maybe happens if you come back.
It was a warning, clear and bright as daylight. The collection was gone, who knows where, maybe in the cellar of some new oligarch. And if John and Kevin tried to return to Tbilisi, they might not come back. Understanding the message, the two friends agreed to let it go and abandon all hopes of ever selling the elusive cellar. John Baker and Kevin Hopko never got to see again Stalin's wine cellar, and to this day, the bottles have never reappeared anywhere else. After briefly re-emerging 50 years after Stalin's death, the lost Ark of Wine had disappeared once again. Maybe some of these antique wines will come out of the shadows again one day, maybe they're gone forever. But what is certain is that the collection did exist, and that John and Kevin saw it with their own eyes. They tasted the Sudiro 1899. John Baker told his story in a compelling book written with Nick Place and first published in Australia by Viking in 2020, Stalin's Wine Cellar. It is this book that I have used to write this story, and I invite you to find and read it, for I have only told you a part of the story, and there is much more to discover in the book. If you've enjoyed this episode, please give it a like on your favorite podcast app, and stay tuned next week for another wine story. Thank you.